We're here to talk about the Reformation this evening. I'll pass on just a few minutes. I'd like to welcome you to that series about the Reformation. There's going to be three lectures in this series. On the 25th of October, we have Piers Carefoot, and many of you will know him from the Fisher Rare Books Library, and he preaches here frequently. He's going to be giving a lecture. And before that, if I haven't met you, my name's Robert Bushakevich, and I'm the Director of Music here at St. James. I'm going to be giving a lecture on the 11th of October, I think it is, to talk about music and the Reformation. If you were at that liturgy beforehand, you will have heard a little bit of the Lutheran music that was beating around that sort of time. But it seems only fitting that I should introduce Adam Bushakevich, who is my brother, who I've known for my whole life. Adam is an art historian and an academic. He studied at University College London and had a master's at the Sotheby's Institute on Bedford Square in London and a PhD at the University of Warwick. And he specializes in portraits from all periods, arms and armor in particularly, valuation provenance, that sort of thing. And he gives lectures at the Wallace Collection on Manchester Square in London, and at the, well, next Tuesday, in fact, he's going to get off a plane from Toronto, and he's going to be very jet-lagged, and he's going to give a lecture at the National Portrait Gallery, so we wish him luck there.
Yeah. On the Wednesday.
On Wednesday. Adam is a fantastic lutenist, and I think that was one of his pathways into all this art. He started playing the lute in his teens. Should tell you that when we were about 14 years old, he bribed me to try to make me do some of his coursework. And now I wish I could bribe him to do my lecture in October. So would you join me in welcoming Adam Bushakevich?
Okay, no squeaking, let's hope. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. As my brother's already introduced you to me, I don't need to repeat all of that again. Firstly, what I would like to say, what a pleasure it is to be here in Toronto. This is actually my first ever visit to Canada, and it's been and it's been wonderful thus far. I'd like to say an enormous thank you for all of those of you who have introduced yourself to me and made me feel so very welcome, especially here in St. James Cathedral, right in the heart of this wonderful city. And the subject for tonight's lecture is one that's, well, really occupied my mind in some way or other for over 10 years. When I was in my late teens, I was particularly interested in history. I went on to do my BA in history at UCL, as Robert's told you. But for some reason, I think I was naturally drawn to, well, the objects that come to us from history. Studying history, you learn lots about politics and philosophy and that sort of thing. But really, after living in Vienna for 6 years, as Robert and I did, I had a strong desire to be drawn towards architecture, objects. How can you learn the past through objects? And particularly the art of 17th century Holland was really something that inspired me straight away. Why? Well, because the paintings that I'm going to share with you today have, in some ways, give us a window to the past that, well, we rarely ever get, let's be honest. If only we had so many wonderful paintings from 17th or 16th century Italy that shows what rooms looked like and also explain so much about what they believed and what they felt and most particularly about their lives. For example, Dutch art has this wonderful tendency to realism. So looking at the real world and trying to not be so drawn into the world of mythology and to even sort of all of the emotional aspects of religion, let's say, but to somehow transport the spiritual into the real everyday world. And, well, continuing from that, I happen to work at this wonderful building, the Wallace Collection. If any of you haven't been there, it really is, in many ways, a treasure box of art. And it is most famous, really, for lots of very flurry and very fancy French art from the 18th century. For example, here you see lots of paintings by François Boucher, painter to Louis XV, and his mistress, Madame de Pompadour, and that's Fagonard's The Swing, which you will see on many chocolate boxes throughout England. It's an absolute icon. But After having worked there for several years now, there is no place more exciting and interesting, honestly, than the Dutch galleries of the Wallace Collection. And why? Well, honestly and truthfully, after watching how people react to art, going around a gallery, I think the average dwell time on pictures is something like, it could be up to about 10 seconds maximum. Imagine that. But there's something about Dutch art that makes people stop and really look closely. These paintings are not only wonderfully painted, but they're absolutely full to the brim with things, with symbols, with all sorts of detail, which just absolutely capture the eye. And if any of you are wondering about this very odd display, and if you're used to seeing Dutch 17th century art in ebony frames, well, believe it or not, the curators actually arranged this room to somehow reflect in the early 19th century when George IV was redecorating one of his palaces. He actually sets off his Dutch pictures with a bright, vibrant blue silk. That's the way they were displayed in the early 19th century, which is almost mad, but it honestly really does work. It is a jewel box, surprisingly. But really, to introduce the subject about, well, how did the Reformation influence Dutch art, and what does it tell us about, well, that period in general, and especially what was going on in the Netherlands? Well, it's a very complicated story, and I'll try and make it short. But in the mid-16th century, there was, in some ways, a revolution, a revolt. The Netherlands, which is this wonderful bit of land here, here's England, just sort of north of France, was, of course, ruled by the Spanish. By the mid-16th century, ruled by none other than King Philip II of Spain. And, well, much like the European Union does today, Philip II wanted to centralize everything, particularly to centralize the Netherlands financially, but also to really break down the barriers. And what I mean by that is the Netherlands, as you probably know, is incredibly densely populated. There are enormous amounts of cities which are hardly, you know, they're sitting next to each other. There are enormous amounts of little regions controlled by those cities. And, well, the revolution that occurred in the Netherlands was not only just because the Dutch were particularly fond of Protestantism, but also the fact that they wanted to sort of keep their traditional way of living, a traditional way of life. It was not so much a radical revolution, but honestly more of a conservative one, if you really think about it. They wanted things to remain the same and not to break down all the barriers about how their regions were ruled by a central state, but wanted to really keep the way that things have been done there since the Middle Ages, in a way. And it is a very complicated revolution to explain, too, because not only was, well, Lutheranism didn't, well, really take hold of itself, especially in the Netherlands. Why? Well, Lutheranism was particularly linked towards Martin Luther. It was linked towards the German language. I'm sure you probably heard from that music earlier. Lutheran hymns are so rooted in the German language that many other countries in Europe didn't take a shine to it as much as the Germans did. But particularly in the Netherlands, certain types of the Protestant Reformation, for example, specifically the theology of none other than John Calvin, took a root amongst a certain section of the population. And Calvinism is a complicated thing to explain. Books have been written about it. I won't go into all the detail today, but effectively, what Calvinism says is that once Christ died on the cross and was resurrected, the promise of our salvation was already, in some way, already secured. Catholics, of course, believe that our salvation isn't secured. We need to supplement it with good works. But the Calvinist faith, in a very simplified way, was all about trying to say, well, our salvation is already secured, but of course there are problems with it. For example, they believed in predestination, or double predestination in some cases, particularly that though there were some who were the elect who were going to go up to heaven, but also at the same time there were those who were sadly not going to make it. And particularly Calvinists were very much interested in, well, how do you know if you are elect? It came out through things like, well, the Protestant work ethic. So looking at there are all sorts of signs that we might know that are a consequence of our election to heaven that, might help us to identify which way we're going, so to speak. And you see this in their art, and this is what I'm going to try and tease out over this lecture. And of course, as in many other places in Europe at the time, the Protestant Revolution brought with it iconoclasm. And let's be frank here. It is very difficult, if one reads the Bible in a literal sense, as the Lutherans and Calvinists really tried to emphasize a genuine reading and understanding of the Bible. Well, we all know what commandment number 3 is, don't you? Thou shalt not make graven images. And an artist once told me, isn't it interesting that the third commandment actually comes before commandment number 6, which is thou shalt not commit murder. So that's, and honestly, the Protestants took it very seriously. And one can understand it. Our Abrahamic tradition, that, of course, Judaism and Islam also follows in a way, is really sceptical of images. And couldn't you imagine being sceptical of cathedrals, all these wonderful medieval buildings, full to the brim with sculpture, with painting, with representations of Christ and God himself? So that causes a slight problem, as you can imagine. But of course, artists, especially in the Netherlands, had always reacted to what was going on in a wonderful way, trying to root it into the everyday life. And one must start this lecture really by just pointing out some of the wonderful works by Bruegel, which really did try to emphasize this point of the changing tide in the Netherlands towards Protestantism, but away from Spain and also the Catholicism that went with that. This, of course, is the Massacre of the Innocents, owned by our great Queen Elizabeth II. It was actually bought by Charles II, nonetheless, who's known for being, as you probably know, a rather merry monarch. I wonder what he found so merry about this. But interestingly, lots of art historians have looked at this picture because Bruegel really set it in a time and space, in the time that he was living. And if we look closer, lots of people have suggested that this group of soldiers here are actually representing Spanish troops who, for decades, spent time in the Netherlands trying to basically win this revolt, this revolution that was going on against Spanish rule. Indeed, this man in black is often said to represent the Duke of Alba, who initiated the so-called Council of Blood to try and root out Protestantism. Rather brutal and rather nasty. But of course, Bruegel also gave us these scenes, which are remarkably interesting. The Sermon of St. John the Baptist. Well, it's also been suggested that actually this scene here, although is representing a biblical scene technically, but actually it's remarkably contemporary, because imagine, during the Dutch Revolt, congregations which were listening to all of these preachers, it was dangerous, especially where you gathered. You never know who might be listening. So often in nature, in the woods, Calvinists, Protestants would gather together to listen to ministers. And you can actually see that the details of this picture are so remarkable that Bruegel has given us contemporary fashion in the mid-16th century to really root us in that period. But really, the golden age of Dutch art, in a way, really started many other things, and it was rooted in many other things too. For example, once the church stops becoming the primary patron of art, which in many Catholic times it always really, in many ways, presided over all of the creation of art, what happens after that? How do artists make a living? And really, in the early 17th century in Holland, we have the development of a truly modern art market, where pictures, because they're not representative of religion and not made for cathedrals and churches, are finding different genres to explore, which makes Dutch painting so interesting and so dynamic and wonderful during this period. This is actually a bookshop, which, as you can see, sells pictures. This is almost a very brand new idea in this period, which was brought about by this revolution against Catholicism and traditional forms of patriotism. And, art does change in itself, but one of these paintings is Flemish and Catholic, and one of these is Dutch. Which would you say it is? Which is which? Firstly, which one is the Protestant picture, or the Dutch? The Dutch one. The one on the right. And the one on the left? Yes. And of course, one of the things that really, shows the complexity of the Protestant Revolution in the Netherlands is, traditionally, in the south, Well, they, fortunately, the Spanish, managed to keep a rather very good hold of places and cities like Antwerp, and thus, only tens of miles away, and within a space of about 10 years, these two paintings were produced. And how drastically different are they? For example, this crucifixion by Rubens here is filled with energy, isn't it? Filled with muscles, filled with colour. It's rather emotional and sensual in a way, isn't it? Even though it depicts quite a nasty scene. But here, of course, we have a crucifixion by that genius Rembrandt. Look how different it is. It's firstly, actually, I should say, much, much smaller. But look at the tones that you see in it. Much more sombre. And one of the things about the Dutch art is that, well, of course, they still produced religious images, but the emphasis is slightly different. This picture is really encouraging us to emphasize with this horrible scene, but this picture is almost, in many ways, trying to give us more of an historical approach, trying to not so much evoke our passions and sensuality, but more of our intellect, in a way. For example, just look at the way that the Christ in this picture is almost boneless, falling off the cross, like a man would be, rather than this Christ here, which looks a bit more like a bodybuilder, in ways, one might say. But anyway, and then, so which, looking at these two pictures, which of them was painted by Dutch painters, which of them was painted by Catholic painters, would you suggest? Well, it's a trick question, because both of these were painted by Dutch painters, which is remarkably confusing. But, for example, these two paintings were painted by Gerard Honthorst and Ter Bruggen, who lived in Utrecht, which happened to be a city in the Northern Republic, which had an enormous Catholic population. In fact, both of these artists actually visited Italy and allowed themselves to be influenced by the works of art of Caravaggio. They brought it back. We know, for example, this picture here was actually in the possession of a man who lived in Amsterdam, a Protestant, which really does confuse things a bit. And, not so interesting to talk about this, but this is also another picture by Rembrandt of a religious scene. But again, you can sort of see the various different approaches that there was. But of course, one of the things that I would like to suggest in this lecture is that the cut really wasn't as clear and simple as we imagine it to be. This is a remarkably famous painting, which is in the Rijksmuseum, by Adrian van der Ven, which is, of course, called The Fishing for Souls. And it really oversimplifies the matter between, well, the Protestant North and the Catholic South. And here you can see this river full of people. And we have two opposing sides. On this side we have the Protestants or Calvinists, and on this side we have the Roman Church. And let's just zoom in a bit. Can you tell the differences? This was painted by a Protestant Dutch painter, but isn't it interesting how these painters are reacting to these changing times? The Protestant men in this boat here are trying to lure in the souls using books and prayers, and actually they don't look too desperate, do they? Yet on this side, the Catholic Church with their robes, with also their icons, with I think that's incense or something like that, are really trying to just lure people in with the sensuality of the faith. And actually, just here we also see another aspect of the sort of Catholic faith. Sorry, it's not a great picture, but this is a boat full of musicians, and I'm sure my brother is this gentleman right here. Because, of course, one of the other aspects of Protestantism, and especially Calvinism, is there's a scepticism towards music. Music is always a difficult thing because it arouses the spirit. What is its role, especially in the church, in terms of prayer and the service? These are all things which questions were being asked at and also hinted at in the art itself. But particularly painters like Gerrit Dou here and other painters were looking at trying to really to emphasize the new the ways of doing things. And especially here we have this old lady here reading the Bible. Bibles in people's own language. But also you can see here that they were quite happy to give pictures in them to accompany the text, to help you understand, to make it in somehow realistic and livable, so that you could put yourself in their shoes, but not in an over-dramatic and and sort of very sensual and emotional way, but in an intellectual way, as I said. And of course, all helped with the fact that all of a sudden now, because we have this, artists are not producing pictures for the church, for example, this picture would have probably never have even been into a church, but of course there are all sorts of new genres that you see in Dutch art, which one often doesn't find in Catholic countries, but I will explain how it's difficult to overgeneralize.